me having the cheapest watch in the room doesn't mean that it can't count 10 minutes. It's a genuine thing, but it works. Good folks, I would like to thank the two ladies, Southern African Media and Gender Institute. Where are you, ladies? Oh, you have since migrated from where I last saw you. Gentlemen, I'm not sure if what has transpired since this morning is a clear indication that men are a dying breed. We are in your able hands, ladies.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address the members of the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs regarding the Refugees Amendment Bill, B3-2010. I also lack the legal background that most of our colleagues here have, so I will be speaking largely in layman's terms. I am here to represent SAMGI, the Southern African Media and Gender Institute. Our organization believes in upholding equal rights and human rights for all individuals within the borders of our republic, irrespective of age, class, culture, gender, nationality, race, sexual orientation, or status. Our comments and interpretations today concentrate mainly on the functionality of the amendment, as it would operate within a social climate that is proven to be racist, discriminatory, and violent, largely towards foreign nationals. Our hope in addressing the committee is that in working together with the government, the laws constructed will adequately reflect the fundamental notions of our democracy and representation. With this mission in mind, it is essential that our reading of the language of today's bill is not bound solely by legal interpretation, but takes into consideration the impact on the affected populations and society as a whole. The rise of nationalism has constituted an aura of protectionism throughout the world, and as you know, South Africa was not immune to this phenomenon. Identity, in its broadest definition, predicates the notion of other, and national identity is formulated by what the other is not, therefore deeming all those that are considered others as foreign nationals. Foreign nationals confront problems of adaptation, including discrimination by the host society, racism, and issues encompassing identity management. Asylum seekers and refugees in the context of the Refugees Amendment Bill, according to the Refugees Act of 1998 and Act 33 of 2008, are not citizens of the Republic and therefore require special dispensation. The primary mechanism that mediates between a state and the people is the law. In theory, the law is neutral. However, in reality, we know that the law mirrors the society that it represents. SAMGI applauds the efforts of the committee to bring about clarification of issues pertaining to the asylum and refugee applicants. These clarifications will enable the professionals in the refugee reception office to undertake their responsibilities in a more coherent and efficient manner. Furthermore, replacing the oversight of applications from status determination officer to a status determination committee ensures applicants are not at the mercy of a single individual determining the merits of their applications. The amendment, in these regards, is esteemed and without contention. However, there are two points that we would like to bring to your attention for consideration. The first pertains to the reconstitution of the definition of biometrics in Section 1 of Refugees Act 1998. The general definition of biometrics is the measurable physiological or behavioral characteristics that can be used in verifying the identity of individuals, as stated in the Refugees Act Amendment in 2008. However, B32-2010 eliminates this definition from the Act, and we request this deletion require further substantiation from the committee. Biometrics requires a specialized technology that can adequately record and retain measurable statistical data. Human rights groups oppose the standard of discrimination, A, for the privacy violations such technology would require, and B, for the racial profiling this policy condones. By eliminating the definition, the government has the power to establish criteria by which biometric classifications are considered. According to this amendment, the data no longer requires measurable standardization, although we do not suggest this method would be practical in terms of resources or ethical. Therefore, the features such as facial patterns would be used to distinguish such origins, and this subjective means of identification places far too much power in the hands of enforcing officers, whose authority could then be open to abuse. The second consideration pertains to the appeals board. The amendment allows political officers to hold a position on the refugee appeals authority. However, this presents a potentially dangerous conflict of interest. Office holders have a responsibility to the party who appoint them as well as the public that they appointed to serve. This may not correlate with the objective interests and rights of the refugees involved. Allowing political figures this kind of decision-making power over marginalized people means that decisions may serve a political agenda and could present detrimental consequences to the applicant. The amendment in its entirety holds incredible potential. However, our objections regarding biometrics and the allowance of political figures in the appeals process still stand. It is our hope that these concerns be taken into consideration by the committee in an effort to create a doctrine that would reflect a fair and just democratic society. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak. It is refreshing to work together with a government body, not as adversaries, but as collaborators, and to realize that we do have shared goals, and it's in our best interest to work together and build upon rather than deconstruct the progress that we've made. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies. Honorable members, comments, questions, points of clarity? It has become standard. Honorable Lovemore.
Thank you, Chair. I don't fully understand the concern about biometrics, and I'd like to. In the 1-3 paragraph of the section on your concerns, which is on page 2 of your submission, it says human rights groups are notably in opposition to the privacy violations of this technology and the racial profiling that this technology allows. Our primary concern is the latter of these oppositions, meaning the racial profiling. Won't you expand on that, please? And I'm asking from a very sincere point of view. I'm a white woman. It's part of my identification. You would describe me as a white woman. Why would you think that this is a bad thing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Kibet.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. On page 2, the deletion of paragraph Section 80 and so on. That last paragraph there. The deletion allows bearers of political office to hold a position on the refugee appeals authority. This is a blatant conflict of interest. I would like to know in what way. Can you just elaborate on that one? You also say office holders have a responsibility, the party who appoints them as a result of election, as well as the public whose interests they are entrusted to them. Now, allowing political figures to hold positions of decision-making power over marginalized people means the decision made are political decisions with probable detrimental consequences. I don't understand the relevance of this point, and I would want you to elaborate. Because if you say that because they are political officers, whatever decision they make will be instrumental to the applicant, I didn't understand what it means. If you can really help me to understand what point you are trying to drive at.
Honourable Member, thank you. Any other comments? None at this stage that I can see. I'll go to the presenters, your opportunity for a rejoin the lady.
issue of biometrics and racial profiling, we find that this has a lot to do with the notion of the other that we were speaking of. And being a white woman, for example, you are classified in the majority. However, when we found across democratic societies that in cases where the minority is targeted for certain things, that racial profiling becomes a tool, and it's abused actually by members that are in power in officials in order to be able to target certain subcategories within the population as people who are cause for trouble, when in fact it should be the people that need the most help from those in power. So on biometrics, it tends to focus on the physical features that would end up marginalizing a large degree of the community, as opposed to those who actually need the support and the help of those in power. For a conflict of interest, I agree. I wouldn't use the word blatant, and looking back on it, I would say there's a potential for a conflict of interest, not necessarily one that would happen every single time. So there is a potential that if one is elected to serve the people and the public at large, granted that they will have to look out for the best interests of the majority, and there is so much animosity between the South Africans that are here citizens and then feeling threatened by this influx of migrants that may or may not pose as a threat either economically or socially, they would tend to cater to the demographics that they serve, as opposed to really taking into consideration the equality and the rights of those who are marginalized and those who come into the community, not as citizens, but as asylum seekers or as refugees. And detrimental consequences, that goes along the same lines, is just they won't necessarily be able to become the voice of a people that's marginalized because they're looking out for the constituents that they've already made themselves available to represent.
Thank you very much. As they say, enige verdere versoeke of klagtes. Geen. There being no further comments or questions, I have to earn my living by thanking the presenters for having made the presentation. Thank you. The issues that you have raised will obviously be considered with all the other issues as we move forward and discuss and debate them as members of this portfolio committee. Eddie, we now go to the Law Society of South Africa. Welcome back. You have made history. The male species seems to survive. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, honorable members, and on behalf of the Law Society, the Black Lawyers Association, and the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, we thank you very much indeed for this opportunity to comment on the bill. Chairperson, just in context, until the mid-90s, the word refugee and asylum seekers, the words refugee and asylum seekers didn't appear. They certainly weren't in the Aliens Control Act for obvious reasons. No one in his or her right mind from the rest of Africa would seek asylum in an apartheid state. And it's ironic, Chairperson, that we don't yet seem to have got to grips with the fact that we are part of Africa, we have African obligations, we have international obligations. It's still regarded with a degree of surprise that refugees and asylum seekers should get these rights. And it's very important to overcome that strange concept that we should really be careful about affording rights to people. It doesn't didn't dawn on us that, in fact, most countries, most free countries, democratic countries, afford these rights. An example earlier today was given of the issue of the death penalty and the torture convention. Most international most countries have signed that convention. Most countries refuse to deport people or extradite people to the United States or to a country like that which has the death penalty without such an assurance. It is not as though South Africa is unique. It is not as though South Africa is suddenly going to be overwhelmed by criminals and terrorists and murderers. We simply need to get up to date that since 1994 we have been part of the African and international community. And it's against that background that the bill and the whole notion of refugee and asylum seeker rights should be addressed. Chairperson, again, the memorandum unfortunately targets the issue of manifestly unfounded. Manifestly unfounded itself is a slippery and difficult and controversial concept. It seems odd that so much attention should be devoted from a mechanistic perspective to the issue of manifestly unfounded applications, rather than seeking to ensure that issues regarding asylum seekers and refugees get addressed efficiently and fairly. Chairperson, the committee has heard today rather diplomatic descriptions of the shocking standard of refugee status determinations. Perhaps a couple of examples will be appropriate. I get people giving me documents where the refugee status determination officer clearly hasn't heard of Kinshasa and yet is dealing with an application from the Democratic Republic of Congo. We get women who have been raped in the Eastern Congo, which is a terrifying war zone, being told, you've been raped now, there's nothing, there's no reason why you should not get, why you should not be rejected. You should go home. We have a woman fleeing the Mugiki clan in Kenya to avoid female genital mutilation, being told, you needn't have left Kenya, there are NGOs that take up these issues there. The situation is absolutely dire, and I subscribe to everything the people before me have said about this cut-and-paste notion. Someone drafted a template, and now at all costs, these inappropriate facts, inappropriate decisions are being shoehorned into a template which is not appropriate. The successors, if there are indeed successes, if this committee is going to come to life, to the refugee status determination officers, have to be properly trained. They have to have some knowledge of the countries involved. They have to have some knowledge of fair administrative procedure. So, Chairperson, what has been said here, there's regrettable ignorance of the Refugees Act, of the relevant countries, country conditions, and the provisions of the UNHCR handbook on how to assess applications. Chairperson, the UNHCR handbook is a magnificent document. It is terribly simple. It is very straightforward, and it is effective. It is an easy guide for determination structures or officials, yet it does not get used. I doubt whether in Cape Town one of the refugee status determination officers has read it. Certainly if they have, they've failed to understand it. There was a question from an honourable member about the failure to provide interpreters. It's classic. There are cases pending in the High Court on that issue. To add insult to injury, there was a statement relating to appeals that if you're going to come to the appeal and you need to you don't speak English, you must bring your own interpreter. That is just a recipe for disaster. It is a recipe for injustice, and the department needs to do something about ensuring not only that the issues are properly explained, but that the issues are properly explained to asylum seekers in their own language. Chip, there's an automatic review by the Director General. It makes one want to weep. I have not had a response to a letter from the DG over the past couple of years. Letter after letter, you get sent requesting some information. You get an acknowledgement, if you're lucky, saying this matter has now been cascaded to X, who will deal with the matter. X does not reply. How the Director General or his or her delegates are going to deal with these automatic referrals is quite beyond me. Just from a logistical and practical point of view, the legal issues, the issues of fairness, are insurmountable. This provision cannot be allowed to stand. At present, the Standing Committee notionally reviews manifestly unfounded applications. It's a rubber stamp. It's a very, where you're decreed to be manifestly unfounded, if you're given a document which you don't understand. Applicant upon applicant has told me, they said, I must do nothing, they've renewed my permit, it's now going to the Standing Committee, I'll hear from them. They don't understand that they have the right to make submissions to the Standing Committee, which, by the way, appears to be ignoring an opinion it received that people should be afforded an opportunity to make representations in person to the Standing Committee. Chairperson, either for appeal, and then there's a further problem. We have heard, as I think was intimated earlier, that the Refugee Appeal Board, in seeking to deal with its terrible backlog, is now only going to deal with appeals on paper. That you can only do fairly if you've got a proper record, if there has been procedural fairness prior to that. Now to have people whose appeals have been pending for a long time, who didn't have an interpreter, who had an RSEO who didn't know where the country was that they came from, and who didn't have any country knowledge or discuss any country knowledge at all, dealing with it is just going to be disastrous. And this provision needs to be radically amended. Paragraph 4, page 3, Mr. Chairperson. Accept and appreciate what an honourable member said about regulations. Given what has happened to date, one will need, I think, more than regulations, but failing those, regulations need to be promulgated very, very quickly to answer the questions raised in paragraph 4. One's concern is that given the backlog, given the pressure under which RSDOs are at the moment, and then given the fact that we're going to deal with the committee, heaven knows how those matters will be approached, what further disasters will occur, Mr. Chairman, and we need to know how the SDC is going to function in each region, how many members are involved, how often it will meet, what its composition will be, how it will deal with matters. Will it simply be a question of dishing out 10 applications to each member of the SDC? One absolutely hasn't any idea. And above all, Chairperson, I want to make it quite clear, I don't think any of the people who've made representations here today have a real problem with the Refugees Act. The Refugees Act isn't too bad. There are a couple of problems with it. It is entirely in implementation that there have been problems, and one fears that this is going to be exacerbated by the proposed changes. Someone earlier today mentioned, as far as the particular clauses are concerned, the non-political crimes committed. You have a problem. Someone may be a genuine refugee who has committed such a crime. That person should not be refouled. It is against all the international instruments. As far as the birth provision is concerned, I would submit that that should be replaced. It's not going to be a huge problem for South Africa. I submit that that should be replaced by within a reasonable time, and that obviously the Status Determination Committee or the Refugee Reception Officer or whatever, seeing pregnant people can notify them. There can be signs put up in various languages that as soon as possible you should register the birth of your child. To make it an offence to fail to do so within 30 days is inhumane in the extreme. A further problem, sorry to go back a little to the SDC chairperson, there's a, in my experience, a bad mindset about asylum seekers from Zimbabwe. It seems to me that there is a knee-jerk reaction. If you say you're from Zimbabwe, you're automatically regarded as a pure economic migrant. That is not the case. I don't think that the proposed dispensation for Zimbabweans, although it's an excellent idea, will reduce the numbers of asylum seekers to the extent anticipated. And above all, there should not be, which there is being, people are having trouble applying for asylum or renewing asylum seeker permits because they're told you must now apply under this different dispensation. The issues should be properly explained. Many people do not wish to apply for that dispensation because they regard themselves as being genuine refugees. It would be dangerous for them to have to return to Zimbabwe. Chairperson, Section 27C and the word indefinitely, paragraph 7 dealing with clause 9 of the bill, indefinitely is enormously problematic. The whole issue is problematic. People have waited for years, as has been pointed out, to have their application determined. The five-year provision at the very least should provide that if it's a successful application, then the period should be from one's entry into South Africa. However, even that is problematic. It's problematic particularly at the moment as far as Angolan refugees are concerned. Genuine refugees from Angola may have been here for 18, 20 years. They haven't yet applied. They do apply. No one can pretend that Angola at the moment is a dangerous country. So that excludes them. They are not going to remain a refugee indefinitely. The portfolio committee, with suspect chairperson, needs to get to grips with an issue. One of the elephants in the room, which I'll get to in a moment, is that of people remaining in South Africa for a lengthy period. It is most unjust for a person from the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville, Congo, from Angola, places like that where there were terrible wars, they have been in South Africa for many years, their children have grown up or spent considerable time in South Africa, nothing to go back to, yet there is a terrible blockage. They are precluded in terms of the Refugees Act from applying in terms of 27C because what they will get is a nasty letter saying, your country is now a land of milk and honey. Not only are we going to refuse your application, we're going to withdraw your refugee status. That doesn't happen to ordinary refugees. It only applies to those who apply to the Standing Committee in terms of 27C, which leads to all sorts of unfairness and means that people who have been in South Africa for many years, who effectively have no other life, are in danger of deportation. So the committee needs to approach, the department needs to approach the issue of the length of time should stay in South Africa before almost getting automatic permanent residence. It's not a novel proposal. It happens in other countries. Even in countries which are regarded as refugee or immigrant unfriendly. Again, getting decisions within 5 days of the decision being made is not in accordance with anyone's experience, Chairperson. It just doesn't happen. And it means that people remain completely ignorant of what's going on. They suddenly get an axe descending on them without any previous warning and without being able to, without understanding that they had an opportunity to address or at least to make submissions to the Standing Committee. And I submit that that is going to be exacerbated with matters devolving upon the Director General. Chairperson, you mentioned the elephant in the room, economic migration. There's economic migration and economic migration. In Zimbabwe, it's alleged, and I believe it to be true, that regions get deprived of food aid because of their perceived political affiliation. That person coming to avoid starvation is maybe regarded as an economic refugee, but is desperately in need of refugee assistance. So one should be careful to consider automatically that people from Zimbabwe are pure economic migrants. The other elephant in the room, Chairperson, again, I think, ironically arising from the fact that we were isolated from the rest of the world for so many years, is the issue of xenophobia. I again believe that if the department, if the media, if civil society were to ensure that refugees were treated with the respect and asylum seekers they deserve, there would be more tolerance, less xenophobia. One should not see in the newspapers officials making derogatory comments about people from other countries and making it extremely difficult for them to get assistance. This business with the banks is an atrocious situation. Business with employment is an atrocious situation. Witwatersrand University's forced migration scheme has published an infinite number of documents quite clearly showing that foreigners do not take away jobs from South Africans. They help the economy, and it is up to us to convey that. The third elephant, which I've already mentioned, Chairperson, is that of permanent residence. Something really has to be done in legislation about accommodating people from other countries who will be of benefit to the country, who deserve to be given a permanent residence. Instead of this limbo that people are in for 18, 20 years without being able to access the benefits they should. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much to the rep from the South African Law Society. Goeie mense, enige kommentaar, honorable member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sure the presenter has been much more eloquent on the issues, and one may not seek more clarity but to acknowledge the extent to which some of these issues are raised. It does seem, though, that more and more we are hearing the issue of skills of the refugee status determination officers and the concern around the composition of the committee. And I think this does not bring any suggestions to the fore. And I would like to seek more and more engagement on the suggestions that, I think you should have, social workers, or you should have doctors, or you should have lawyers. You know, those kind of things are important. I see the suggestion that you have on page, I think that's page 2 of the document. Sorry that there is no clear indication in the deal as to what exactly will the constitution of the SDC will be, and of course how often it will meet, and all those kind of concerns. I think that is important, and I'm sure, Chairperson, as we continue to engage, the department will also assist us so that we understand exactly what is going to happen insofar as this matter is concerned. The other one, of course, we'll hear so many comments some for or against, but I think most of the time, all those who have presented, they are so much against the notion that there are people who are criminals who find themselves in this country. But the reality is, if you go on the ground, there are criminals who are the language, who are somewhere living happily in South Africa, whilst they have escaped the might of the law where they come from. And that issue, of course, there are international treaties that the South African government has entered into, and it wasn't fair to recognize those. But we should seek means and ways to address this within our domestic environment, so that we do not in any way expose those who are law-abiding citizens. And of course, we have nowhere else to run to but exposing them to dangers that we are fully aware which exist elsewhere around us. A situation is the one where we have two gentlemen from Botswana who are somewhere in South Africa, and in fact who are waiting for a deportation, and they cannot simply be deported because Botswana is going to Botswana is going to hang them. Now they are saying to us, no, please don't send me to Botswana because they are going to hang me because I've killed somebody. But the issue here is that we should not encourage that people who have faltered in their own country, when they come here, they will be safe. You can imagine how many people are going to flock into South Africa because they know that they will be safer here, having wronged the people in their own country. So these are very, very important. The other issue, the last one, Chair. Here we seem to have a very loose and a generic statement that is being made. Somehow it might be that it's not a remark that is made intentionally, but I think we need to listen to some of these remarks made. I think there's some disingenuity that when you talk about serious crimes, there are no serious crimes. When a person has killed a person, or a person has raped a person and convicted in that country for having done wrong, and now here we are saying that we should not think that those are serious. I think there's a very sluggish comment there that I see coming time and again. The other one is, of course, that we should be taking seriously the issues of xenophobic violence in our communities. But I think it's a matter of social cohesion and how we manage those issues of education in our societies to deal with the other. The ladies were putting that. Chairperson, I think this is very much key and certain. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mateo. Good day, Ms. Lovemore.
Thank you, Chair. Just a point of clarity, not being a lawyer myself. On page 2 of the submission, reference is made in point C an automatic review by the Director General without the asylum seeker being afforded opportunity to make submissions being procedurally unjust, and that I understand. And then, Chair, it speaks about the possibility that the Director General will have to delegate this function, etc. And then in point F, it says such a procedure will, it is therefore submitted, lead to considerable substantive injustice. And I don't understand that as opposed to the procedural injustice. Thank you, Chair.
Any other member? There being no hands at this moment, I'll go back to you, sir. Your chance for a rejoinder.
Thank you, Chair. The one issue on skills, very easy. We don't need hugely qualified people in terms of of professions or degrees as refugee status determination officers, it would be quite easy to, for instance, base capacity to be on either the committee or as to be a refugee status determination officer on a couple of tests. Familiarity with the United Nations handbook for determining refugees, understanding what the onus of proof is, the burden of proof, knowing familiarity with the requirements. So if you don't know that you can seek asylum, you qualify as a refugee in South Africa on the basis of sexual orientation, you've got no business being a refugee status determination officer. And that remark is directed at the person who recently said that a man from Uganda, where you for a brief period had the death penalty for being gay, didn't qualify as a refugee. It's not that difficult to ensure that people are capable of doing their job in terms of the acts. I wouldn't require further degrees. As far as criminals are concerned, no one is suggesting for a moment that common criminal conduct should go undealt with. One needs to get proper extradition agreements. One has to get a proper assurance that the death penalty will not be imposed. No one is suggesting that criminals go unpunished. These floodgates are imaginary. People who commit serious crimes in their own country, unless they're on a genocidal scale, generally get apprehended. It's quite difficult to get to South Africa. South Africa has signed the Torture Convention many years ago. We have not had floods of people coming in, as it were, seeking asylum from the common law of their countries. It's an imaginary problem. And, Chairperson, there's a case which, with respect to the Department of Justice and the Department of Home Affairs, appears to be in contempt of at the moment, K.K. Mohammed versus the President of South Africa, where it was established quite clearly that you cannot extradite or deport a person who will face the death penalty without getting that assurance. It's not as though it's something dreamt up in the last year by lefties from Lawyers for Human Rights. automatic review. There's no doubt it's both procedurally and substantively unfair. The substantive issue is simply that largely because of failure to comply with procedural safeguards and procedural fairness, you will get a situation where a genuine refugee will be rejected. So that will be the substantive unfairness. Someone who qualifies as a refugee, but because the refugee status determination person couldn't be bothered to find an interpreter or couldn't be bothered to listen through or didn't understand what the issue was, the person then got told, right, this matter's going to the standing committee, come back in 3 months' time. They come back, and very rarely in 2 months' time, after a couple of extensions, so a year or two later, they will then get a rubber stamp decision from the standing committee upholding the facts as seen by the status determination officer, which will then lead to a genuine refugee getting rejected. And Chairperson, again, I do not contend that every person who applies for asylum is a genuine refugee. The fact is, the better trained your officials are and the more efficient the process, the fairer it will be to everybody. Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Chair.
Are you fine, ma'am? You know, I would like to remind the House that what we seek to do here is obviously to invite stakeholders to assist us in the best possible manner in helping to form the best possible legislation. It can never be perfect, but the emphasis is on the best possible. The importance of stakeholders is that perhaps on a more day-to-day basis, month-to-month, year-to-year, you engage with organs of governance, the department, officials of the department, and then in that interaction, you are able to see strengths and weaknesses and forward suggestions as to how best we can address this. Our role in Parliament is in the main to formulate legislation. And once laws have been formulated, ratified, is to look at the unintended consequences of some of those laws and regulations and how best to mitigate those. So it's an ongoing process where we also as Parliament conduct what's commonly referred to as oversight visits, the various provinces to look at how a department carries out its functions and responsibilities. That's part of our responsibility as members of Parliament. Obviously, at this level, it's also unavoidable that stakeholders, in articulating their vision as to what's supposed to happen, seeking to guide Parliament here, their frustrations with the day-to-day encounters with departments will also be foregrounded. That is to be expected. But the most important thing to remember is to say, presently this is the dispensation that we have. What other aspects can we do to improve and mitigate the circumstances there? Then this will assist all of us to better frame better laws. So from different ends of the table, what binds all of us here is to formulate the best possible legislation that we can for the citizens of this country, and also bearing in mind the legal, international legal documents to which we are signatory to, how best to carry out those responsibilities as well. So this is the purpose of this exercise here. We just need to recall that whilst we are sitting at different ends of the table, but the purpose is one. Having said that, we still have one more presentation before we go and break for lunch. The presentation that it has that wonderful acronym, PASOP, which in Afrikaans means be aware. So I would like to welcome, if I recall from the last engagement, the man underneath the cap. It's Hanekom. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I would like to recognize the valuable contributions before my presentation and add our endorsement to the LHR submission, to the Lawyers for the Law Society submission, and also to indicate our endorsement for the Unitas One submission and also the Scalabrini submission, because I think they were very valuable, and I think we encourage the members to take them very seriously. As I'm speaking after Mr. William Kerfoot, I must say there are many elephants in this room. And I think that as we look into the situation in certain countries, we have to recognize that in certain countries, the right to a free trial is compromised because of a political meddling and a majority rule. And in certain cases, people accused of criminal acts would not be given the opportunity to a fair trial, and as a result may well have criminal charges because of political beliefs. I think one such example could be the treasurer of the MDC, Roy Bennett, who was charged and convicted of crime, criminal acts, and fled on that basis. And I'm aware that there are elephants in the room. Chair, we are extremely concerned about the amendments and the way they've been flaunted in the media by Home Affairs as being a method of accelerating refugee status determination. For us, it's not just a change of policy, it's a change of systems. We're not used to a judicial system that has a jury. We're used to a system where there's a judge. And if one's to say that a jury would be quicker than a judge on determining whether or not an application is fair, I'm not convinced. I do agree, however, that the committee is a more legitimate and fair mechanism of determining whether or not somebody is a legitimate applicant, but is also it's also less corruptible. So we do recognize the benefits of having a committee, but we don't like the insinuation that the committee would approve or reject asylum applications at a quicker speed than individual refugee status determination offices. For us, we are really concerned, because while the laws are passed at one level, what happens on the ground, like mentioned previously, can be very different. And we are really worried that the reason for pushing the amendment through at this time would be to accelerate refugee rejections, not necessarily refugee determinations. We are aware that last time we witnessed accelerated refugee status determinations was following the xenophobic violence in 2008, where the department very kindly accommodated the displaced who were undocumented, many of them under Section 31(2)(b) of the Immigration Act. The minister provided cards which gave them exemption from the immigration requirements. That's for the undocumented migrants who were among the displaced. Unfortunately, they did proceed, however, to do refugee status determination of people applying for refugee status and demanded of people on those Section 31(2)(b)s to apply for asylum if they wanted to be documented. Those temporary cards, I think, were valid for a six-month period. The result of that accelerated refugee status determination was a 98% rejection rate. We know that even the UNHCR spoke out against the results of that accelerated refugee status determination, and therefore we are really we're extremely concerned with an outstanding number of about 400 odd applications that an accelerated process may result in the rejection put a large number of people outside of legal standing in this country, which for us has not been the approach of Home Affairs this past 2 years. We understand that the Zimbabwean dispensation has been recommended to deal with people who might not be asylum seekers, who might want to be here for alternative purposes. We also recognize, like William Kerfoot mentioned, that there is a tendency to label people from particular countries as being opportunistic economic migrants, as though the decision had been made to come and steal jobs and to come and engage in crime and other such things. For that reason, we are extremely concerned about the Zimbabwean situation. We do not see Zimbabwe as a country that's stable. We do recognize the improvements. We are not taking away from the great role that South Africa has played in the negotiations and to the reaching the point of the global political agreement. But we are aware elections are coming. We are aware that there have been reports of violence as the constitutional reform Kariba process has been going forward. And therefore, we are extremely concerned that that South Africa is making it appear, or has already politically made the statement, that Zimbabwe is a stable country, whereas we do not believe that Zimbabwe is a stable country, particularly with elections imminent. So for that reason, we believe that whether under a different act, but hand in hand with the act, it's necessary for us to accommodate people from countries that are from, that are fleeing instability, and people who are not given any certain future if returned back to their countries. The act carefully says that people who rejected refugee status will be dealt with under the Immigration Act, and our understanding is that means deportation. We don't see any other mechanism being provided for people who've been rejected status other than deportation. It's been indicated that the moratorium on deportation is stopping at the end of the year. That announcement preceded this amendment, and we are really concerned about that. From our perspective and our understanding with working with communities, I can confidently say that the xenophobic violence we saw in 2008 was a result of South Africa deporting in excess of 200,000 people annually, was a result of immigration rates in townships where immigration officials, NIB, National Immigration Bureau, or immigration branch officials, went door to door demanding documents, often hand in hand with the community, often with local community councillors involved in such raids and immigration raids. And therefore, we're extremely, extremely cautious and worried about the stability of all foreign nationals in townships. Should the amendment bill go through, it may well give the go-ahead for deportation of large, large numbers. And should the Immigration Bureau branch take it upon themselves to implement, quite rightfully so, the Immigration Act, the result will be quite likely, in our opinion, a resurgence of violence in communities. It is really a concern for us. So I think our submission is primarily about the lack of accommodation for the large number of outstanding applicants. We know that there's been a long debate in America about what to do with Mexicans who've been in America, some of them for 15 years. We recognize that asylum seekers from countries like Zimbabwe, some of them have been in South Africa in excess of 5 years on asylum seekers documents, and looking at the American situation, I think even Obama in the Senate has been pushing for them to accommodate the people who are already in the country, but then to strengthen border control, because the witch hunt that would happen would definitely lead to big tensions in communities, even in a stable or relatively stable country like America. In the South African context, we will see blood on the streets, and that is our concern, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you on behalf of PASOP. Honorable members, comments, questions? The Honorable Love Moore.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I have previously heard in discussions with other role players, the issue of the very high rejection rate constantly comes up. It's inordinately high, it appears. In the report that was compiled by the Forced Migration Studies Program, that is linked very much to an incentive to reject because positive decisions are automatically reviewed. Would you see a change in that review system as something that you from PASOP would support? It's put forward by the Forced Migration Studies Program as a recommendation, or what would you see as something that should be in the bill to address the inordinately high rejection rate? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member Baba.
Chairperson, the point was raised earlier by the Lawyers for Human Rights on the standardization of the residence for those who have been here for a period longer than 5 years, the times who may at the later stage been granted asylum or refugee status. that they be accommodated and be naturalized. I think that is a very good point, and I hear Pastor raising an issue which he says an attribute to the xenophobic violence that we had in 2008. I do believe that, yes, it does have some degree of certainty if one look at the reasons, among many, as we've seen and heard from the USMCR and other organizations. But I do believe that probably one needs to look very closely as to what is it that we can do to manage the situation of those who have been declined, who have been denied status as refugees. I think when the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee made a point that what we seek to address here, we seek to have a mechanism that will allow us to work together instead of working in silos, thereby having a system that will help us as a country to manage the issues of refugees. So I do not get the recommendation, therefore, chairperson, as to what is it that we can do other than the statement which you've made, Mr. Yanuko. So I'd like more details from your side, even if it's on the basis of statements now, but again, if it was more documented, it would have helped as a suggestion. The last point, chairperson, is the you know, this issue continues to come up of the status determination committee vis-a-vis the RSPOs. Yeah, and I think it's a matter of the reason why there is this uncertainty about how it can work better, which one would be best between the RSPOs and the SCC, is because there are no clarity or there's no detail in the bill. And I think it will be better, you know, as we move on, to ensure that that detail is clear, even if it won't be necessarily, you know, be on point by point on the bill. But again, you put as a very clear point that the regulation will guarantee such. The last part, or the very last, of course, is that I'm worried about which one is best, chairperson. We want speed in dealing with the issues of, you know, status determination. Yes, we need speed, but then when the results are given, the question is, why did the speed give or yield such results? So I need to check what is the best way. When we need speed, what results are we expecting? So that we understand, if the results say no, we are not a refugee, then how do we deal with those issues? So that when we say we need speed, and I know that we need quality as well, but we just need to put some mechanism in place, chairperson, so that when you remove this, you put something on the other hand. Thank you very much.
I thank you, honorable member. Any other member would like to comment? Honorable member.
Yeah, just a point of emphasis really. I've seen that in the last presentation, I think from the beginning, it's clear that there has to be, and it's just to add on the point that was made by the last speaker. I think on the Status Determination Committee, we need to move forward. The principle of a committee as opposed to an individual, I think must be supported. And then secondly, to say that I think moving forward we need to look at the issue of empowerment, training and skills in order for the committee to be able, because I think these committees will be provincial. So in dealing with the concerns raised, we need to deal with this criteria for appointment, we deal with the issue of skills training and so on. So at least, even if it's a committee, it is able to come up with decisions which are rational. And I agree with the comments of the Law Society that you don't necessarily need maybe graduates per se, but you need people who are quite aware with all these treaties that govern the whole question of refugees and asylum seekers and so on and so forth. People who can deal with these matters eloquently and in the best interest of the country as a whole, because everything that we do here, we're not just doing it to accommodate people, but also to get the interest of our own country in dealing with this particular matter, so that we don't compromise the interest of our own citizens at the expense of just trying to look nice in the international community. So I think we need men and women who can serve there with distinction, understanding the work at hand. I thought I must just make that general comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ranuko.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Firstly, I would like to just point out before I address the answers to the questions that the problems I'm talking about are problems that are pre-2008. We have to be clear that in our opinion as PASOP, we have seen great improvements at the department. The quality of staff and the speed of which they deliver services has increased. It's not at a level that we would say is acceptable yet, but it has improved, and we have seen improvements. The methods of detaining people and the large numbers of deportation have decreased substantially in the last 2 years. So we are positive that the department can implement positive systems, and they've been doing so. Addressing the questions, I think the issue of the lower, the high rejection rate, we have to again support what William had spoken about, and also what Kajil had spoken about in terms of providing for in the Act provisions that would define how the committee would operate. Because if it's not defined there, then it's any person's guess on how the implementation will work, and it will depend on the administrators, not. It won't be guided from a legal perspective. I'm not a lawyer, but that's my understanding of it. So I think we would encourage the honourable members to take up the Lawyers for Human Rights in their suggestion that they might be willing to submit a proposal on how that committee would be structured. And I think we as an organisation, and I think most organisations have a lot of faith in them. So what that proposal would be could be very useful. In terms of how to accommodate people who rejected, I think that is a very good, legitimate question, and I think that the department had proposed providing permits like what they've done with the Zimbabweans at this moment. However, the requirements of the Zimbabwean passport and obviously the cut-off deadline doesn't provide an opportunity for people who want to migrate from the system. And in all honesty, members, we must remember that the applicants vary very much in education levels in their capacity to understand what refugee status is. So we do find situations where a lot of people apply for refugee status in an attempt to get documentation to survive in South Africa with absolutely no understanding whatsoever what the term refugee means. Therefore, you actually have women who've been raped. Sometimes when they're asked why on their application, why did you enter, they might write they came for a job or for a better life. Doesn't neglect the possibility that there may also be legitimate refugee applicants. So I think there's a need for an immigration policy. And I think in terms of recommendations, our recommendation in terms of this bill would be to ensure that if it is to go ahead in the manner in which it looks like it is going ahead, that the department undertakes to extend the deadline for that Zimbabwean dispensation, and that the department also accepts to further elaborate on their suggestion of permits for economic migrants and people who are here for other reasons, because we are supportive of that suggestion, and the process of the Zimbabwean dispensation project has been implemented quite well in Cape Town. I think the biggest problem is the Zimbabwean embassy and the Zimbabwean authorities getting Zimbabweans' passports. That's been very, very difficult and is taking a long time. in terms of the need to regulate migration, we need to recognize that when somebody's rejected status, you've made them illegal. So if we're going to agree
or if the portfolio committee is going to sign and to go ahead with a process which we all agree should accelerate, should be done quicker, because it shouldn't be necessary to wait so long. The provisions need to be elaborated and re-explored, because my understanding even of the Freedom Charter is that no one shall be deported without fair trial. Now, I'm not familiar with any trial that's provided for in the Immigration Act. In fact, if somebody is found to be illegal as a rejected applicant for refugee status, and they haven't applied against their, I mean, appealed against their rejection, then they are entitled to, I mean, the state is entitled to deport them, and there's not much further investigation into the issue. So I think for us, our recommendation is to, you know, taking from what we've seen today, is to ask LHR and ask the committee if they're willing to accept the submission around it, and we're willing to contribute and work closely with them on that. In terms of improving the quality of the status determination committee or status determination officers, I think the recommendation from William Kerford around utilizing the UNHCR handbook and getting further training should actually be somewhat incorporated in the Act if possible. Thank you, Chair.
Musanuko, we can't incorporate everything into the Act. Otherwise, even the Bible doesn't incorporate everything. Equally, we have to be realistic in terms of legislation. But that does not mean to detract from your input. Good folks, what remains is for members to continue interacting with your written submissions that you've made, and today we have the benefit of your presence to better elaborate on the submissions that you have made. And at a future date, that Eddie, the committee secretary, will advertise. We'll have our deliberations in one of the venues of Parliament, hopefully a bigger venue, where we'll go through the presentation submissions with the department, and members of Parliament will apply their minds to all the issues that you have raised. All that remains for me to do to earn my living for the day is to say meeting adjourned. Thank you very much to all stakeholders.